All right, so I guess anybody want to ask any questions about the midterm? Hopefully the plan is to have the grades, the scores, uploaded on BSpace by Tuesday. So hopefully we'll have that done fairly quickly, okay? All right, a couple of announcements. Also on Tuesday, assignment 4 is due, okay? Assignment 4, there's a whole bunch of work coming together. I did my best to spread it out as best I could on the syllabus. But just be aware that there's a bunch of stuff right now. You've already done the midterm, obviously. We have the field trip over the weekend. Assignment 4 is due on Tuesday, and then the field trip report is due fairly soon after that. So there is a bunch of stuff. So don't leave things to the last minute, was my suggestion. Okay, and so then assignment 4 is due on Tuesday. Please don't put it in my mailbox. This is a plea coming from the GSIs to you guys to please don't put your homework in my, as in Richard Allen's mailbox. Put it in the class mailbox. It causes all kinds of confusion. Okay, this weekend, rain or shine, we will be having the second field trip. It's sort of very similar to the first field trip in that it's basically a sort of two-hour walking tour. This field trip will be looking at the landslides in the Berkeley Hills. This is really cool stuff, okay? We're going to go not look at the fault. We're going to go north of campus, and I'm going to show you where the sides of the hills are very gradually sliding down towards the bay. And you can see the effect of that in the homes, as the homes are all being deformed. It's really quite incredible. And it's just in a normal, you know, typical neighborhood of Berkeley. And in fact, there's a whole series of these that goes all the way up the Berkeley Hills. So it's really quite incredible. So we are going to go and look at these slides. The one thing that is a little different but is very important, because you need to know about this to make sure that you actually get to the field trip. So first of all, you sign up for a field trip. There's 10 slots, I think, starting tomorrow, running through the weekend, and then on Monday. So go on to BSpace and sign up for one of the field trip slots. There are 30 slots in each of the times. We will not be meeting at the North Gate. This is the important part. We will not be meeting at the North Gate. We will be meeting at the intersection at the intersection of Spruce and Glen. This is obviously from the class webpage. Click on the field trips, and then click on field trip 2, and this is the page that you see. This is the north gate of campus, so right now we're sort of over here somewhere. This is the north gate of campus where we met for the first field trip. This is the intersection of Spruce and Glen, and that is where we will be meeting for the field trip. Okay, and so the idea is still that it's a two-hour field trip. So if you sign up for the 9 o'clock field trip, we will meet at the intersection of Spruce and Glen at 9:20. It's about a 20-minute walk from the north gate of campus to where we meet. Okay, so if you sign up for a 9 o'clock field trip, that means you need to meet us at Spruce and Glen at 9:20. Okay, we will then go on the field trip, which basically goes around these streets, around about here, and we will come back to the same starting point, and the goal will be back here at, so if with the class, if it's a 9 o'clock field trip, we start at 9:20, we will be back there at 10:40, so that the idea is you can be back on campus at 11, plus or minus 10 or 15 minutes. Okay, so that's the idea. So the idea is it's 2 hours away from campus. Does that make sense? Please pass that on to friends who, for whatever reason, are not here right now, because otherwise they're going to be waiting at North Gate unless they actually read the instructions. Okay, any questions about this? It's the same thing as before. You know, bring a notebook, bring a pen. We will just be walking along streets. There's no streams to go through, which is good given the weather we've just been having. Okay? Excellent. Well, I can see three heads nodding down here, even if nobody else. Okay, so let's get on to today's topic. Oh, all the things I was just telling you are right there. Okay, so we now are into the final third of the class. Okay, so let me remind you, the first third of the class was kind of the impacts of earthquakes or the history of earthquakes, understanding why we should be concerned about earthquakes, understanding what has happened in previous earthquakes. The middle third of the class that we've just completed was sort of the science of earthquakes, if you like. How we understand, how we record data from earthquakes, how we constrain earthquakes, how we characterize earthquakes. And now the final third of the class is about what we can do. How do we stop or reduce the overall or the impacts of future earthquakes, both here in the US, in the Bay Area, and around the world? So that's what we're going to be talking about for the rest of the class. We're going to talk about, we're going to look at specific examples. So on, what day is it today? Thursday. So on Tuesday, we will be looking at a specific comparison of what happened in the Northridge earthquake and the Kobe earthquake. And there are some very big differences between what happened in those two events. And so I want to kind of look at that so that we can understand what are the impacts. Now you understand the science behind earthquakes, yeah, you'll be able to see why there was a big difference between those two earthquakes. So that's what we're going to do on Tuesday. We're then going to talk about earthquake prediction. We're going to talk about earthquake forecasting. And then we're going to talk about earthquake early warning. And then we are going to switch gears a little bit and talk about how we engineer structures so that they can withstand earthquakes. So seismic engineering, obviously, is the most important aspect of how we reduce the effect of future earthquakes. And so the last week and a half of the semester, we'll be talking about seismic engineering. Okay? So that's kind of the overview of what's coming for this last third of the class. And so to kick that off, I want to specifically talk about what the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory does. So the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory is a research unit here on the Berkeley campus. And what the Berkeley Seismolab does is runs several geophysical networks. So we actually collect the data that we've been talking about for the last third of the class. And then, of course, a variety of research-type activities associated both with mitigating earthquake hazard, but also broader questions about structure of the Earth. And so I'm going to just tell you a little bit about the Berkeley Seismolab. Everybody who's instructing you in this class is a member of the Berkeley Seismolab, so it's very important you see this in a very positive light, for your grades, I mean. And so I want to explain what we do and how this rolls into earthquake hazards and earthquake research in general. Okay, does that all make sense? Do you see the big picture? We have such a small group of people today, we can have a conversation. Okay, so let's talk about what the lab does. So I have a few not so exciting slides, but I feel like I have to show them to you, and then we'll get into some much cooler stuff. Okay? So first of all, what's the mission of the lab? You're all students, obviously, here at UC Berkeley. You're all majoring in something, or will major in something. And so what you see of the university is primarily the academic departments. Okay? Some of you may end up, my academic department is Earth and Planetary Science in College of Letters and Sciences. And some of you may end up majoring in Earth and Planetary Sciences, I don't know. But you will all end up majoring in something, and you will be associated with one of these academic departments. And what you will primarily see is the teaching mission of that academic department, which is obviously a very important part of what the university does. But it is not everything that the university does. This is also a major research university, as you probably know. A significant proportion of the dollars that are spent here on campus are actually for research, and they fund fundamental research into pretty much everything. And so the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory is one of these research units. Okay? So it's not an academic unit. It's not an academic department. We don't have students. We don't grant degrees, rather. We do have students. But it's a research unit. And so in addition to the graduate students, the faculty, the postdocs, there are also professional researchers associated with the Seismolab. Okay? So the mission of the Seismolab is fundamental research, number one. And so we run several of the geophysical networks in Northern California. I'm going to show you that in much more detail. And that data is the basis of a wide range of fundamental research, not necessarily to do with earthquake hazards at all, but much broader research associated with structure of the Earth. And so number one of our mission is this fundamental research that is being done by people in the Seismolab, but also all of our data is immediately openly available to anybody over the internet. And so researchers around the world use the data from the Seismolab in order to study all of these things that I'm talking about. Number two is hazard information. Now, whenever there's an earthquake, I think I may have mentioned this 1, 2, or 10 times already this class, but whenever there's an earthquake in Northern California and you hear about it on the news, they will say something like, the USGS reports a magnitude 3.4 earthquake in the so-and-so area. So in fact, as soon as anybody's talking about an earthquake, it's big enough that the magnitude estimates actually come from us, the Berkeley Seismolab. The USGS actually is not able to provide magnitudes, accurate magnitudes, for earthquakes above about a magnitude 3.5. And so that's just one specific example of the kind of real-time hazard information that we provide. We, in collaboration with the USGS, collect the data, detect earthquakes, locate earthquakes, estimate the magnitudes, estimate the impacts of that earthquake in real time, and then the USGS delivers that information to the public. And so that's the hazard information component. Number three is broad education. So, of course, you could count this as being part of the educational goals of the Berkeley Seismolab, but also much broader education, education of the public, things like that. And then the last one, of course, is professionalism. So this is a research unit within UC Berkeley. There's about 50 people that are part of the Berkeley Seismolab. So that's faculty, staff, technical staff, engineering staff, IT staff, administrative staff, postdocs, students. It's funded partly by UC Berkeley, but mostly by external sources, federal funding to run the network, state funding, foundations actually support the operations of the Berkeley Seismolab and also the research goals. And then this is the kind of little, here's my top six bullet, five bullets, top five bullets for the history of the Berkeley Seismolab. So this year is the 125th anniversary of the Berkeley Seismolab. The Berkeley Seismolab started in 1887 when, in fact, it was the host, or it's the forerunner to the Berkeley Seismolab, was the host to the first seismometer in the Western Hemisphere in 1887. I'm going to show you where that was in a few moments. So that was sort of the beginnings of the Berkeley Seismolab. In 1906, of course, we've talked a great deal about the 1906 earthquake, and in particular, the Lawson study after the 1906 earthquake. And the Lawson report was the birth of modern-day seismology, and Andrew Lawson was, of course, a professor here. In 1961, one of the earlier WWSSN stations was installed. Anybody remember what the WWSSN was? Standardized seismological network. That's right. So this is the first global seismic network that was being basically deployed because of the Cold War in order to detect nuclear tests around the world. And one of the first stations was, of course, here at Berkeley. And in fact, that vault, it's this, I'm not sure if I've talked about this before, it's this tunnel that goes into the side of the hills just up above the Berkeley Botanical Gardens. And it's this sort of shaft, a horizontal shaft that goes into the side of the hills with the seismometers at the back. Of course, we don't have the same instrumentation that we had in 1961, I'm pleased to report, but we still use that vault. It's a very quiet vault. It's a standard vault. It's actually used by a lot of the instrument manufacturers to calibrate their instrumentation. 1991 was the first continuous broadband seismic network in the US, and then I was very pleased to add this final one this year, which earlier this year is when we have the first automated response to earthquake alerts. As you know, the BART trains now stop automatically when an earthquake is underway. So that's a little bit of the history. Okay, so this first seismic station was actually at Mount Hamilton. So in 1887, the first seismograph in the Western Hemisphere was put in Mount Hamilton. This is has telescopes. It's for astronomy purposes. And in fact, the first seismic stations typically were put wherever there were some sort of astronomical installation, because to have a good seismic record, you needed good time, and where you had good time is where all of the astronomers were based. And so the first was actually put at Mount Hamilton, which is right here. Mount Hamilton is a UC Berkeley facility. And that was in the fall of 1887, and then in the spring of 1888, the second station was actually put on Observatory Hill, which is basically 200 yards that way, right next to the building that the Berkeley Seismo Lab is in today. And so this is a recording of the 1906 earthquake. At those times, the instruments had these plates that were moving in a circular fashion, so they have a time history, so you can sort of see the seismogram. This is the seismogram with time. And so this is one of the recordings from the 1906 earthquake at Mount Hamilton. So we're very proud of our history. This is what the network looks like today. So of course we're based here. This is actually, we're in the Cone Hall. And so we're based on the Berkeley campus, but our facility is actually across all of Northern California. This is the broadband seismic networks, includes all of these stations, including one which is on the ocean floor in Monterey Bay at the end of a cable. The green is real-time GPS, so this is high sample rate, high precision GPS. And then the pink there are borehole networks. So those are instruments that are at the bottom of boreholes, and the reason that they're at the bottom of boreholes is to get the instrumentation much closer to the fault so that we can record the very low amplitude signals associated with much smaller seismic activity. And so this really, when we talk about the Berkeley Seismo Lab, it's this network of instrumentation that is the reason that we exist, not so much the presence here on the UC Berkeley campus. Okay, so that's the network that we operate and that we use. And so this just kind of summarizes what are the components. The whole idea of the Berkeley networks is to record broadband earth motion signals. And what we mean by that is we want to be able to record all types of earth motions at all types of frequencies, which means on all types of timescales. Okay? And so it includes the BDSN, the Berkeley Digital Seismic Network. That's this network that is called the Berkeley Digital Seismic Network. Of course, all seismic networks are digital today, but Berkeley's was the first digital seismic network, so that's why it has digital in the name. And so that's the broadband velocity instruments and the accelerometers that are across Northern California. And this is the reason that we are the ones that estimate the size of earthquakes, okay? Because we have this broadband instrumentation, so for very large magnitude earthquakes, we can accurately estimate the size. The borehole networks, I just mentioned, a cluster of borehole networks down here in Parkfield. You all know what Parkfield is now. Parkfield's a very important place, despite the population of only 18. For the seismology community, we run a borehole network down there. And then also borehole network up here on the Hayward Fault. Real-time GPS is kind of brand new. This is kind of one of the technologies of the future to actually see the motion on the faults in these big earthquakes. And then, of course, this ocean bottom instrument. The reason it's important, this is the ocean bottom instrument, the reason that it's important is that we want to have instrumentation on both sides of the faults, right, so that we can do a good job of locating earthquakes, things like that. You want instrumentation on both sides of the fault. And the problem is that this is the San Andreas Fault, runs up here. And so if you want to have instrumentation on the western side of the fault system, that basically means that they have to either be on, this is the Farallon Islands, this is the tip of Point Reyes, and then this is the MOBB, the ocean bottom instrument. So that's why ocean bottom instrumentation is really important. Any questions?
Mm-hmm. Or just, I guess, where the fault would be around there.
So the borehole networks, the instruments, the boreholes are typically about 100 meters deep, okay? And so that's, you know, boreholes, that's fairly deep, but of course, the fault themselves, as you know, the fault that ruptures during these big earthquakes, it can rupture all the way from the surface down to 10 or 15 kilometers depth. And so our 100-meter deep boreholes that people use for seismic instrumentation is actually just scraping the surface. But the reason it's important to scrape the surface is that when you record signals right at the surface, the very surface few tens of meters of the earth are very unconsolidated sediments, typically. And so they actually make a mess of the signals. So by getting below that layer, a few hundred meters deep, you actually have much cleaner signals, which is really important for the very low amplitude signals, the small types of events. So that's why we have borehole networks. Okay, but we don't just work in a bubble. We work in a collaborative way with what's called the CISN, the California Integrated Seismic Network. And so this is now a collaboration of the groups that run the seismic networks across the states. And that's UC Berkeley, the USGS, and then Caltech in Southern California. And so Berkeley and the USGS run separate networks in Northern California, although the data actually streams to both places. So there's redundancy. And then the USGS and Caltech started to run a single unified network in Southern California after the Northridge earthquake. So the Berkeley network is part of this bigger sort of federated network system. And it's that system, so the CISN, that provides all earthquake information in the state of California. Okay? And so in Northern California, so the Berkeley Seismic Lab detects, locates, characterizes seismicity along with the USGS. And this is an example. This is this particular version of the maps are no longer available on the web. But this is for the Alum Rock earthquake, which was a magnitude 5.4 earthquake here in the Bay Area back in 2007. It's the largest earthquake we've had in the Bay Area since the Loma Prieta earthquake. And so all of the information that goes into these maps comes out of our system. So typically earthquakes are located within about half a minute, and then the initial magnitude estimate is first available in about 1.5 minutes. So this is the regular real-time system. You guys are now all aware of earthquake early warning, and of course the whole point of earthquake early warning is to do all of this in a matter of seconds. So we are now doing that, but that's brand new. This is the sort of standard real-time earthquake information system. We also then determine moment tensors. We've talked a fair bit about moment tensors in this class. And again, this is for the Alum Rock earthquake. This is the automatic moment tensor determination for the Alum Rock earthquake, which was located right here. Here's Alum Rock. So what type of fault does this indicate? It's a strike-slip fault. And what's the orientation of the slip? Yeah. Okay, and how can you tell that? So in fact, looking at this, you can't tell that it's right lateral. You're right, it is right lateral. But you can't tell that, right? So the blue is the blue is black and the yellow is white. I wonder why it's yellow and blue. And so you're right that obviously it's consistent with right lateral. It is right lateral. So something going from here to this quadrant and then from here to this quadrant, that's what makes it right lateral. But in fact, also it could be going from this quadrant to here and from this quadrant to here, and that would be left lateral. So it's either right lateral on a fault plane that's oriented like this, or it's left lateral on a fault plane that's oriented like this. And so why is it right lateral? I see everybody doing this. I assume that means because we know the fault is oriented like this. That's right. So obviously we know the fault is oriented like this, and so this is right on the fault, and so it makes sense that this is a right lateral fault. But you can't tell if it's a right lateral slip. But you can't tell if it's right lateral or left lateral just looking at the moment tensor. You need some other information. Anyway, the reason that these moment tensors are important is that we see this, and we know the location is on the fault. We immediately know that this is an earthquake on the Calaveras fault right here. We know it's an earthquake on the Calaveras fault with the kind of slip that we expect, so we have more information about this particular earthquake. How do we determine the moment tensors? Rob talked about the process of determining moment tensors using the first arrivals, which is whether the first arrival is up or down. That obviously is a way of determining moment tensors, and in fact that's how the USGS determines moment tensors. We actually do something that's quite a bit more complicated, but also provides us with much more information, in that we actually fit the waveforms. And so what's shown here is three component waveforms. Okay, so this is the vertical component, this is the radial component, the tangential component. Don't worry about what that means. These are the two horizontal components, And this is for 5 stations for this Alum Rock earthquake. And the solid line is the data. Okay, so the solid line is the data. The dashed line is a synthetic seismogram. The dashed line is the seismogram that we calculate for this moment tensor. So the way that this works is that you record the real data, and then you determine a moment tensor that gives you the waveforms that best fit the recorded waveform data. So we're not just deciding whether a particular seismogram is first motion up or first motion down. We're actually fitting the entire waveforms, which provides much more information than just fitting the first arrival. So that's how we actually go about it. The details of that don't matter. I just want you to know that that's how we go about it. This provides a more accurate magnitude estimate, magnitude of 5.5. And then, as I said earlier, we then, of course, don't know whether this is the fault plane or this is the fault plane based on the moment tensor, but based on its location and knowing something about the geology in the region, we know that this is the fault plane and this is a right lateral fault. Okay, so that's one of the other products that we provide. Moment tensors typically take a matter of a few minutes after an earthquake to determine them. And then over time, we build up a picture of the state of stress of all of California. So we determine these moment tensors for all of California. This is the moment tensors for all of the earthquakes bigger than about a magnitude 3.5 or maybe magnitude 4 in California for the year of 1993. And I think, yes, as I just step forward, I'm going to show you plots of the distribution of earthquakes and the moment tensors for each year. And as you know, by looking at the moment tensors, we know that this is a strike slip type fault. We know that this is a thrust type fault. And there are a few cases where we see some normal faults. This is a normal fault. Okay. And so as we kind of step through time, we understand what's the state of stress for all of California by kind of looking at the total sum of all of these moment tensors. So that's kind of in the longer term why understanding moment tensors is important. You can see that the places where we see most of the seismicity are Mendocino, this region up here, which is where we have the triple junction at the northern end of the San Andreas Fault. Of course, along the San Andreas Fault system, and you can see that there's sort of a fairly significant variability in the amount of seismicity from one year to the next. And then the other region is Long Valley and Mammoth Lakes. That's this trend of seismicity that runs up here. And in fact, we're not going to get into the details, but what's going on right now is the San Andreas Fault is moving from here to over here. So come back in a few million years, and the San Andreas Fault is going to be going up the eastern side of California. And in fact, all of California will likely be attached to the Pacific Plate. And we can tell that because we look at the moment tensors. Okay? All right. Yeah, I know that's a wild card. Just thought I'd drop that in. Okay, so then in terms of real-time information, we generate shake maps. So shake maps are where you go and you take the location of the earthquake, you take the magnitude of the earthquake, and you take observations of the peak ground shaking, and you come up with a map that shows the distribution of ground shaking for a particular event. This is, again, the Alum Rock earthquake. It's a fairly small earthquake. It's just a magnitude 5.5 earthquake. And so the distribution of ground shaking basically looks like a bullseye. Okay? Although you can see some regions where the shaking is a little stronger, such as here, for example. Why is the shaking stronger down here? It's a valley, right? It's the deep valley full of sediments, and so we get amplification type of effects. Okay? And so this is available in about 8 to 10 minutes. Actually, now it's closer to 5 minutes. That the shake map becomes available. And this is what the emergency response community uses to figure out where to send their resources. Yeah? Oh, okay. So this is, this is a bit of a wild card. I don't expect you to understand this. This is kind of an interesting thing to know about. Okay, so the San Andreas Fault system, 2 minutes. Is somebody going to time me? So the San Andreas Fault system runs down here right now, okay, and so that's where you're seeing all of this seismicity. But as you know, there's this big bend down here through the Los Angeles region, and then the fault continues down through this. This is the Salton Sea, and it continues down into Baja California down here, okay? So you can see that the fault already comes up, makes a big left bend, and then continues up here. You can see that there's this very unusual orientation. This is the Garlock fault, this fault right here, with this sort of triangular region in between. And so what is actually happening? The San Andreas fault, of course, wants to just be a nice straight strike-slip fault. And so what is happening is that the motion that's on the San Andreas fault down here is gradually beginning to transfer up at this series of faults and then continue up this long valley up to Mammoth. This is Mammoth. And continue up what is essentially the eastern side of the Sierras. Okay, and so over time, that some of the motion that's currently accommodated here is actually transferring over here. So the prediction would be that in the long term, a few million years, tens of millions of years, that the motion will completely stop here, and instead the motion will be taken up over here. Is that less than 2 minutes? Question? Sorry, what is the fault? Right. Yeah, so this series of faults that run down the eastern side of the Sierras runs through Mammoth Lakes. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question or not. Okay. Oh, it's not the San Andreas. This is the San Andreas. There's no question about that. The San Andreas does not run back here. The various faults that run up here have various names. There's little segments. They all have different names, and I don't remember all of them, to be honest. It's not the San Andreas, though. Okay? We'll keep going. All right, so that's the... So that's the real-time information part of what the Berkeley Seismolab does. What I want to do now is sort of fairly quickly tell you a little bit about some of the research that goes on at the Berkeley Seismolab. Now, seismology, the field of seismology, you can think of as being divided into two primary areas. Seismic source studies, which of course is what we spent the entire class talking about, pretty much. And then structure studies, as in structure of the Earth. The Earth has a solid inner core, for example. It has a liquid outer core, and then it has a viscous mantle. All of those things we know from seismology, from the fact that seismic waves travel through the Earth's interior. We can record them at the surface and collect information about it. So I'm just going to skip through the source study stuff and get on to the structural study. So, of course, I showed you locations, moment tensors. We talked about nuclear discrimination, discriminating between what are nuclear tests and earthquakes. We've talked about rupture processes a little bit in this middle third of the class. We are going to talk about prediction, forecasting, and early warning. Obviously, those are all parts of seismic source studies. I'm not going to talk about this. This is the discrimination of nuclear testing in North Korea. I will show this. This is a little... Oh, no, I'm not. I'm going to keep going. Okay, so how do we know... The question is, do you guys need to know it? No, you don't need to know those two slides. Well, the nuclear discrimination one we've already covered. The rupture slide is... Okay. So how do we know about the internal structure of the Earth? Because we don't really talk about this in any other part of the class. Well, the first thing you can do is dig. Okay, you can dig a hole. You can collect samples. The problem is that the deepest hole ever is 12 kilometers deep. Okay, what's the radius of the Earth? Anybody know? Okay, somebody guess what's the radius of the Earth in kilometers. 100? Say again? 600? 6,000? 10,000? Wow, that's a remarkably good guess. It's actually not quite right. I'm not sure where you read that from. The average radius of the Earth is 6,371 kilometers. Okay? That's the average radius. The Earth, of course, is not a perfect sphere. It's an ellipsoid. But the average radius is 6,371 kilometers. So 12 kilometers, of course, is, again, really just scratching the surface. That's my point. So the deepest hole, and there's two holes, actually, that got to 12 kilometers depth. Most holes that are drilled don't go more than about a kilometer, a few kilometers. Some of the deeper oil exploration wells now go a few kilometers deep. But 12 is a very extreme borehole. That was drilled specifically to get as deep into the earth for scientific purposes. Most boreholes, of course, are drilled for exploration purposes. So that's obviously just scratching the surface. So this is the problem. We do have some samples, though, from deeper in the earth. And these are essentially lumps of rock that have been brought up to the surface by geologic processes, what we call xenoliths. Okay? And so chunks of the mantle, material that we think has come from a few hundred kilometers depth, potentially, does get brought up to the surface by volcanoes. So these chunks of material get dragged up to the surface in magma, and we, you know, erupted out on the surface, and we can then go and see them, collect them. And so that actually does give us some samples from deeper in the Earth, sort of a few hundred kilometers at most. But that's it. That's still only a few hundred kilometers. So the rest of it requires indirect probes. Okay, and so there's three kind of areas here. Potential fields. So looking at gravity, studying the how gravity varies over the surface of the Earth, actually provides us with some information about the Earth's interior structure. The magnetic field, we talked about the magnetic field in the context of plate tectonics, but that tells us about structure. Electromagnetic also tells us a little bit, but not a huge amount, to be perfectly honest. It's the seismic constraints that really provide the most information about the internal structure. And the reason for that is that seismic energy, as we've talked about this, the fact that we have, you can think of energy radiating from earthquakes through the Earth's interior as having these ray paths. And so you then record the seismic energy on the other side of the Earth, and it's telling you something about what it's seen along that ray path from the earthquake to the station. So we're actually probing along this very narrow little strip of volume inside the Earth's interior. And so seismic constraints are a really key constraint on the structure of the Earth. Okay, so that's why seismology is important for structural studies as well. So how does this work? Well, you have an earthquake somewhere. That earthquake generates energy, seismic waves that radiate through the Earth, and so are affected by Earth's structure and then recorded as seismograms at the surface of the Earth. And so in order to be able to do this, we have to understand wave propagation. We have to understand how these seismic waves travel through an elastic medium. The Earth is an elastic medium. We have to understand how that wave propagation occurs and a variety of approaches of doing this. And then also we use inverse theory allows us to take our set of data, our seismograms, constraints that we extract from seismograms at the surface of the Earth, and reconstruct what the Earth's internal structure looks like. That's called inverse theory. And this is what's one particular approach to this is called seismic tomography. That's one of the things that my group spends a lot of time doing. In fact, all three of the GSIs sat at the front are doing seismic tomography, as it happens, this year. So this is how seismic tomography works. Okay, this is a 2D problem. Of course, the Earth is 3D. But so you have seismic stations that are recording data. You have an earthquake. So the earthquake occurs, and energy radiates out from this earthquake and is recorded at these seismic stations. Okay, and so some energy travels from the earthquake, say 100 kilometers, to one seismic station, and we can record the time that the energy arrives at this seismic station. Okay, and so let's say that for whatever reason, this energy, it actually gets there a little more slowly than we would expect. The data arrives here 1 second slower than we might actually expect along this particular path. But then on another path, maybe the data gets there a little earlier. It's fast. Okay, it gets there 1 second faster than we might expect. So we have some sort of 1D average Earth model, and then we can see whether the data gets there early or late relative to that 1D model. And so this is arriving more slowly. This is arriving much faster. Okay. And so now imagine that you have multiple earthquakes and you have multiple stations, and for all of these earthquakes, you have ray paths. Oops, what's going on? Okay, you have ray paths that are coming out to all of these seismic stations. These two are arriving fast, and then these four are arriving slow, and another earthquake, but from this earthquake to all of these stations, they all arrive relatively fast. For this earthquake, a bunch of relatively slow paths and a few, or one, fast path. And then finally, from this fourth earthquake, again, a bunch of slow paths and a bunch of fast paths, okay? So that's the data that we have, and we can then use that data and we can invert to determine what areas in this is a 2D example, obviously, what areas in this 2D example are relatively fast and what are relatively slow. Clearly, this region in the middle here is a relatively slow region because all of the energy traveling on paths through this middle region are relatively slow. Okay? Clearly, this region over here is relatively fast because most of the paths traveling through this region over here are relatively fast. This one's the anomaly. This one, of course, is slow, but this is sort of traveling through this region over here and traveling through this region over here. So you have to kind of consider maybe it's slower for this portion of the ray and then it's fast for this portion of the ray, but because this portion of the ray is longer, the overall time is relatively slow. So you can kind of see how we can reconstruct what the structure of the Earth's interior in terms of it being fast versus slow looks like, and that's what seismic tomography is. So you do an inversion of this data, and it shows you what regions of the Earth are fast and what regions of the Earth are slow. Okay? So that's what seismic tomography is. And we literally divide the world into blue and red regions, the red regions being relatively slow regions and the blue being relatively fast. But then, of course, we can interpret this. What causes the seismic energy to travel fast, blue regions, or slow, red regions? The most important is actually temperature. So the parts of the Earth's interior that are warmer than the average, the seismic waves travel more slowly. So red, that's why we color them red, right? Red is hot. To first order, when you see seismic energy traveling slowly, it means that the material is relatively hot. And when when the region is relatively cold, it travels relatively fast. And so that's why we color fast regions blue. So red means hot, blue means cold. Of course, it also depends on the chemistry, and the chemistry of the Earth's interior does vary, but in fact, it turns out that temperature is the most important factor. Okay, so we can just assume it's all temperature to start with. Yeah? I'm glad somebody's reading the slide. Both of these say it travels more slowly than normal. I'm sorry. So this is correct. Red means that seismic waves travel more slowly. Blue means that seismic waves travel faster than... I'm going to change it right now because I will forget by the end of class. And then next year we'll have the same problem. Okay. Okay. There we go. Well spotted. There was another question at the back. Same thing. Okay. All right, well spotted. So that's how we interpret the seismic waves. And so I'm going to show you an example from the Pacific Northwest. Some of you are from Oregon and Washington. I know it's a very small number, but the Pacific Northwest includes a little bit of northernmost California. The reason that this is a very interesting region is that, as you know, there is subduction going on of the Wondafuca Plate. So here is, let me orient you. This is Washington here. This is Oregon and then California. This is the northern limit of the San Andreas Fault at the Mendocino Triple Junction, where all those earthquakes were occurring. And then this is the subduction, this is the trench, where the Wondafuca Plate is diving down beneath North America. And so these blue lines are actually contours of where we expect the slab to be as it dives down beneath North America. Okay? So first of all, in the Pacific Northwest, we have this subduction. It's an ocean-continent collision, and we have subduction going on. And although this is a relatively small plate, the Wondafuca plate, like to remind everybody, this is the size of the rupture in the magnitude 9 Sumatra earthquake, and it's basically exactly the same size as the subduction zone of the Wondafuca plate. And we know, in fact, that most earthquakes in the Wondafuca along the subduction zone are magnitude 9 earthquakes. They don't come around very often, but when they come around, they're magnitude 9 earthquakes. Last one was when? 1700, can we be more precise? What month? Okay, what day? Wow, I'm impressed. All right, so that's the subduction. And then the other interesting feature here is that Yellowstone is right on the edge of this map. This is the Yellowstone National Park, which Yellowstone National Park is believed to be at the top of a mantle plume. We talked about the unusual source of volcanoes, that volcanoes that were not happening in a subduction zone, and we talked about Hawaii. Hawaii being a mantle plume. Well, Yellowstone is also a mantle plume, believed to be a mantle plume. So in this region that's mapped here, we have subduction going on, and we have upwelling of what's believed to be a mantle plume beneath Yellowstone. And, that's a detail. Okay, so I'm going to show you a tomography model. This is a seismic tomography model that was developed a few years ago now. The most recent version of this particular tomography model is, in fact, Rob's thesis. This is his model is the DNA 12, as in 2012 model. This is the DNA 08 model, so a few years ago. And so we're starting by, I'm going to show you a 3D visualizer view of this of the structure in this region. Okay, and so this first of all, you can see this big circle here. That's the Earth's core. So we're sort of looking through a translucent Earth. This is obviously North America. This is Australia on the other side of the Earth. Okay. Oh no, sorry. This is Australia. I'm sorry. This is Australia. So this must be Antarctica. Sorry. Okay. But so this is. We're just going to look at this portion of the Earth. Which is where the model is, okay, and covers that region that I just described. So let's zoom in a little bit, and you can immediately see this blue region. This is a horizontal slice. Remember, blue means cold, red means hot, okay? And so what's this? It's what? It's the bay. Okay, so we need a little more orientation here, I see. So this is Vancouver Island. I know it's difficult to see. I'm sorry. I'm so used to looking at images like this. This is Vancouver Island. Okay, so the northern edge of this model is the U.S.-Canada border. Okay. This is obviously Baja, California. All right, so the southern edge of this model is essentially the California-Mexico border, all right? This model, this is, you know, Southern California. This is Northern Washington. Okay, sorry, my mistake. So, what do we think this blue thing might be? Somebody said Cascadia. What do you mean by Cascadia? Mountains. Actually, this is a slice at about 100 kilometers depth. Actually, maybe deeper, maybe 200 kilometers depth. So mountains, we expect to see the roots of mountains in the continental crust, and sort of what's the maximum thickness of continental crust roughly? I heard somebody say about 70 kilometers, okay? This is at about 200 kilometers depth. So this is not the mountains. This is deeper in the mantle. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. This is the subducting Wondafuca plate. So the coastline here, it's sort of difficult to see, but this is the coastline. So the trench for the subduction is sort of just a little bit offshore here. At 200 kilometers depth, this is the slab. So the Pacific plate is kind of coming like so, and then it dives down and goes down deeper into the mantle. And the deeper you go, the further east you expect to see the slab. So this cold region here, this is actually the subducting Wondafuca plate. Okay, I'm going to show you some other images in a minute. This red means hot. This is actually the upwelling beneath Yellowstone. This is the upwelling that's responsible for all of the volcanism beneath Yellowstone. Okay, so this is our model. We're going to look at it in a little more detail. So the same, we're looking vertically down. So this is a slice at about, I think it's about 200 kilometers depth, I guess we're about to see. So that's that slice. I just rotated this on its side so you can see the total model volume. So this is the northern edge. This is that subducting slab. This is Yellowstone. This is the southern edge, basically the California-Mexico border. And we're going to look at this model that goes from the surface down to about 1,000 kilometers depth. Okay. So we're going to continue this. The orientation is not going to change now. We're going to look at this model box, and I'm going to show you various slices in this model box. I'm actually going to show you a whole series of vertical cross sections through the model box. Okay. So these are vertical sections, east-west sections, through the entire model box. There's a little map down here. Let me go back so you can actually see it before all the lines. Here's the little map. And so this is the Mendocino Triple Junction. So this is California, right? You just about see the California borders. This is Oregon. This is Washington, okay? And so we're going to look at a series of cross-sections. This is the first cross-section that we're looking at right here. And we're going to start by looking at this one, and we're gradually going to march our way north looking at these cross-sections. Everybody with me? I'm trying to orient you. Okay? So, I skipped over. Let me point it out on here. So this cross-section here goes right through here. Right? So what's this here? That's us. This is where we are, okay? So right here this is the Bay Area. And so right now, we are located right about here in this model. Just to give you a sense of scale here. But let's go further north to the more exciting parts. So this is the east-west cross-section now, looking basically at the Mendocino Triple Junction. And this is the Gorda Slab. So because this is the coastline and the model doesn't have constraints once we go offshore, we can't see the plate offshore. But this is the plate diving down into the mantle, reaching about 600 kilometers depth. So this is the cold oceanic slab diving down into the mantle. And you can see it becomes less and less blue with depth. That's because it's gradually warming up as it's surrounded by relatively warm mantle temperatures. Going a little bit further to the north, we see the Gorda slab still, but it's kind of becoming a little weaker. Further north, we're still seeing it. It actually looks like it extends to greater depth. This is actually what we think is a remnant slab. You see it has a parallel dip. We think this is actually an old slab that's maybe about 60 million years old that is hanging out in the mantle while the Gorda slab continues to subdip next to it. As we get further to the north, the gap between these two opens up. So this is still the present-day subducting slab. We're now into Oregon at this particular point. The slab is becoming weaker. You saw that on the horizontal map view that I showed you at the beginning. It kind of, this gap opens up. The slab is bottoming at about 500 kilometers depth at this particular point. Note that we're sort of about to get to Yellowstone. Yellowstone is just a little bit north of this particular line. This is the slice that goes directly east-west through Yellowstone. And so this is this big, hot region that's directly beneath the Yellowstone caldera that's the responsible for all of that volcanism that is going on beneath Yellowstone. You still see the slab, and then there's this much more complicated stuff going on in the mantle between these two regions. We're not going to get into that. A little bit further north, you actually see the continuous plume conduit. So this is this hot material that extends all the way from the lower mantle through what's called the transition zone and then continues all the way up to Yellowstone. So we actually see evidence here for the source of the Yellowstone volcanism coming from deep in the Earth's mantle. So this is, in fact, what was some of the first evidence for a continuous plume beneath Yellowstone. You still see the slab over on this side, but it's much shorter and stubbier. So there's some other complicated processes going on with this this subducting slab. Okay, I think I'm going to stop here. So I just want to make sure I'm clear here. I'm sort of not really expecting you to perhaps fully understand everything that I just showed you with seismic tomography. But what I wanted to leave you with was a sense of how we study the structure of the Earth's interior, this concept of seismic tomography, and then show you some real data that illustrates some of the tectonic processes that we've talked about, i.e. subducting slabs and upwelling plumes. All right, thanks.